much do you think about soil? Yes, I'm talking about that brown stuff under our feet when we go hiking, or perhaps the stuff my dog just loves to dig up, but only when I've just planted a new shrub in the garden. Soil accounts for about 10% of the Earth's surface, but it's a precious natural resource that deeply affects every other part of the ecosystem. I hadn't really thought much about the importance of soil until this conversation with Scott Gooding, nutritionist, exercise coach, author, and the founder of the Good Farm Shop. But as you will hear, Scott is super passionate about the benefits to soil that are brought about by regenerative farming. We covered in this conversation what regenerative farming is and how it can positively impact our precious ecosystem and the climate crisis. We also talked about what the barriers are to the uptake of regenerative farming, both from a business and a consumer point of view. We covered how extreme crises like the pandemic have impacted our values and the way that we work, the impacts of media sensationalism and catastrophizing on action and division on society, and so much more. This is a real variety of topics in here. Scott was born in Britain, but he's lived in Australia for the last 20 plus years. And as I spent many years living in Australia myself, it was great to reconnect with the Southern Hemisphere for this chat. It was very, very early in the morning for Scott and quite late at night for me, as the seasons here turned towards summer and for Scott turned towards winter. Funnily enough, I'm actually recording this intro on the summer solstice in the UK, which is also the winter solstice in Australia, which feels like a bit of a spooky coincidence. I hope you enjoy this episode. Scott, welcome to the Easy Being Green podcast. I'm so happy to have you here today.
Thank you very much, Shani. Thanks for having me.
All the way from Australia, the other side of the world.
I know, it's just starting to slip into the cooler months now. We've had a pretty amazing summer actually, and it's just starting to cool down, which is quite a relief, to be honest.
Yeah, I bet. I still have lots of friends in Australia, and they were telling me it was just a little bit too much this year.
Yeah, it gets like it was a slow one to start. It didn't really begin until sort of Christmas, and then we just had lots of hot consecutive days, and it gets, I mean, I should really complain, to be honest, but it gets a bit oppressive, and you're kind of, you know, now it's cooling off, it's a welcome relief.
And you're saying that to somebody who's here at the beginning of spring in the UK and it's raining. Us Brits, we love to talk about the weather, don't we? It's a terrible thing.
Yeah, my mum's in the UK and she says it's still cold. She's still getting frosts and stuff. Like, that's insane.
Yeah.
And I was just saying offline, we were there at Christmas and it seems so long ago that we had Christmas. It's, you know, it's 4 months ago or whatever it is, 3.5 months ago. And it was so cold then. And I can't wrap my head around that it's still cold now. Like, it just seems such a long time ago. But yeah, you guys do it rough. That period between the 2nd of Jan till about now is like, you got to get your head down and bum up, haven't you? You just got to trudge through it.
Power through and stay distracted. That's the way to do it.
Netflix and the such. Yeah,
that's it. Lots of woolly jumpers and hats. So it's so miserable. I should come back to Australia. What did I do moving back to the UK? Honestly,
I don't know what you're doing.
So Scott, you wear a lot of hats. You're a nutritionist. You're an exercise coach. You're an author and the founder of the Good Farm Shop. I'd really love to start today by hearing your journey. How did you get to where you are today?
Good question. I guess I've always had an interest in physiology. You know, I started life as a exercise, you know, I studied exercise physiology at uni back in the UK, actually, before I moved here in 99. And then sort of stumbled through, you know, those early years here, dabbling in various odd jobs and odd industries, and then I ended up being a personal trainer and was deep in exercise, and for many years thought that that was the sort of the biggest lever that we had to kind of be the best versions of ourselves. Then I started to dip into nutrition, and over the course of probably, you know, 5 or 6 years, that kind of flipped on its head. And I realized that nutrition was the biggest lever that we have to health, well-being, longevity. And it's not to say that exercise doesn't play a part, it most certainly does, but it's sort of, I guess, because I was so entrenched personally in exercise, like I just ran everywhere, and you know, I was the mad guy that you'd see running hills and stairs and sand, and but also I guess running sort of parallel to this, I injured myself in 2005. I sort of ruptured some discs in my lower back.
Ouch.
And it sort of plunged me into a period of depression and pain and discomfort, and that lasted for about 7 years. And I tried, I guess, knowing the mechanics of the injury, I tried to fix myself in a very mechanical sense, like most people do. You know, you go and see a physio, you go and have massage, you get cracked, you have acupuncture, all these sort of tried and tested methods of healing. And I didn't really get anywhere until in that eighth year, around 2012, 2013, I started to read about and tune into how some foods were pro-inflammatory and some foods were anti-inflammatory. And at that point, I really had nothing else to lose. So I started to systematically adapt my diet to be more anti-inflammatory.
Right.
And I became quite militant about it. I'm sort of one of those people that are sort of all in or all out, you know. So I didn't do things by half measures. I went quite militant, and I became, you know, people stopped inviting me for dinner because I was so rigid around what I was eating and what, and probably more importantly, what I wasn't eating. And I started to see the results. So I started to, you know, and this isn't a clinical trial. It's just, you know, N equals one. This is me. This is my experience. This is the case study that I experienced. And so my pain started to recede, my movement started to come back, and obviously with that, I got myself back, my happiness and well-being started to return. And that kind of gave me the fuel and the impetus to continue spreading a message around nutrition and how potent that can be.
Right.
So then I sort of, I got out of personal training, I got into deeper into nutrition. I studied to be a nutritionist and a sports nutritionist, and so I guess that's where I am now. But probably about 10 years ago I got the opportunity to write some books, and so over the last 10 or 12 years I've written 9 books.
Wow.
And I've and they're sort of very much health books and cookbooks, and but I guess even with that first book I was talking about provenance of food, like it is important to understand where our food is coming from. Obviously there's layers, there's things that we need to sort of acknowledge, and those are things like accessibility, budget, all those types of things. So I'm not that person that says, you know, you have to have organic and you have to know your farmer, and it's like they're all nice things to know and to have, but it doesn't apply to everyone. I'm just sort of saying that we just need to open our eyes and our ears and even start to have those conversations about where our food is coming from. So I guess running beneath all that, I'm a chef as well. I grew up in the UK. My mum and dad ran pubs, and so I've always been around food and fresh produce, and I'm very passionate about health and nutrition. It just so happens that I love cooking as well. So that definitely has sort of got me to where I am now, in the sense that I own a company called The Good Farm Shop with my wife. And I guess it's the amalgam of all the things that I love and all the things that I've worked on over the last 15 years. It's that collision of food, nutrition, and provenance of food, which is sort of the identity, if you like, of The Good Farm Shop. It's all those things combined. That was a very long-winded response to your question. Sorry about that.
No, never apologize. I love people's stories, because everybody has a story to where they got to today. And I think it inspires other people on their journey as well, because you can, long gone are the days where, you know, my dad was a teacher for 25 years. And I think we just evolve so much more now. So you can start off being one thing and completely lead to something completely different. And I love to hear how people got to where they are. And then in 10, 20 years time, you know, you'll have another story to tell.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. And that's actually why I'm in Australia, because I finished my degree in 98. And to me, my next foot forward was into the career that I was going to be in for the next, you know, like your dad, like a few decades, because I was mirroring my parents, who had run pubs at that point for, you know, probably 30 years.
Yeah.
And they had another 10 years of doing that one thing. And then there was a bunch of people, you know, my peers, that, you know, even the ones that didn't go to uni, they were 5-10 years into their career. And I was like, I have no idea what I want to do. Like, certainly not for the rest of my life. So I deferred that decision and then jumped on a plane and went to the other side of the world, just to simply not have to confront that decision. I was like, well, I'm going to allow myself another year. And yeah, you're right. Like, I think, you know, there are some people that, you know, want to be the doctor or the teacher or the, and they fall into that job and that's them. And that's, you know, that's, I guess it's horses for courses, right? I'm one of those people that kind of gets a bit restless if it's a bit too samey.
But in saying that, you've written 9 books. I just wanted to say congratulations for that, for doing that, because writing, my mum's actually an author, and it just overwhelms me how people can sit down and write a book and you've published 9.
Yeah, I mean, some of those are cookbooks, which is a different thing altogether. So it's not like I'm writing a novel. but there are some that are sort of more, you know, a wordy health book. But you know, when you're talking about something that you're passionate about, and I enjoy, I still write now, you know, not writing a book per se, but, you know, I write several times a week. I write articles and blogs, and I enjoy the process. I think writing is, you know, probably in some ways a dying art form, but it gets you thinking, because you have to, like having a conversation, I have to articulate the thoughts in my head before I utter them. And the same thing happens, but probably on a more precise level when you're writing, because, you know, as you're formulating the sentence, it can go in any direction. So you have to then articulate in your brain what that next word is, what that next sentence and paragraph is. And it's a very creative process. And it enables you to think and think long and hard about it. Anyway, I enjoy it. It's so what does your mum write? Does she write?
She started off her career as a a playwright, so she wrote for theatre, and then she moved into films. And in her retirement, she's started
Right.
writing novels. Yeah, which is a different genre
Amazing.
for her.
Oh,
Yeah,
no.
she's
That's
a
awesome.
talented lady. So tell us more about The Good Farm Shop. What problem or challenge do you want to solve with your business?
I guess there's two that spring to mind. One is improving soil health and sort of remodeling. So a step back from that. I think one is to, in some ways, and I don't know how this reflects in the UK. Actually, I was in the UK at Christmas, and you guys have your streaks ahead of us in
Do you
terms
think?
of, yeah, I do.
Wow.
In terms of, like, if you walk into a supermarket, and admittedly, I didn't go to all brands and all chains, but the ones that I did, you guys have amazing labeling and, animal welfare labeling and regenerative farming labeling and organic and all that. Like, you guys are streets ahead of us, that's for sure.
That's
So
interesting.
I guess one is I want to be a player in attempting to remodel our food system. We've got a very sort of upside down food system in, I don't want to speak for the Brits, but in Australia, it seems that we've very much plugged into an industrialized food system. So on the fringes and in the margins are sustainable farmers and regenerative farmers, and it's a growing movement. That's for sure, but it's still quite niche, and I think we can get into the mindset for the few that are playing in this space that, we're taking the world by storm. But the reality is it's a bit of an echo chamber. We're all kind of talking to each other, and we're on each other's podcasts, which is all great, but we can get this sense that we're bigger than we are. But I think the reality is that, and it's not to say that we'll ever take over the industrialized food system. That's a juggernaut, and I brush up against it quite often in the work that I'm doing and the work that I've done in the last 18 months with the Good Farm Shop. I get to see that system because I'm working alongside it. So it's not to say that I'm not naive enough to think that a regenerative food system will sort of muscle out the intensive food system. But I think that there's enough, I'm hoping there's enough room for both of us. So in a sense, that one problem I want to solve is that, and I sort of touched on this a second ago, is that it would be great if people were more cognizant of where our food is coming from and how the animal is raised and how that cob of corn or head of broccoli has been grown. Because there's implication, like the discussion on meat versus non-meat or meat versus vegan isn't the discussion. To my mind, it's actually where all food has come from and what food system that has plugged into. So you can be vegan or you can be a meat eater, but you in either channel you can contribute to poor soil health and poor ecology. It we need to kind of eradicate that, and I've been talking about that for a while. So I guess one problem I'd like to contribute to is this sort of unconscious shopping and unconscious eating that many of us, and it's no one's fault, it's just a product of the time that we're in, that food can be produced on mass, on scale, and it floods our supermarket aisles, and it's always there, and there's an abundance, and we can shop freely, and it's a privilege. I'm not denying that. It's a privileged time to be be alive. We can just walk through our supermarket aisles and we can just pull off the shelves and pull out the fridges. But I think that the time is now that we need to kind of ask that question about where the food has come from. Yeah. The second problem I want to solve, I can't remember what it was. But I think that's probably like, if I can contribute in some, yeah, I think the two go hand in hand, right? So if you encourage people to think about where that food has come from, and maybe then that informs their purchase, you know, and what food system they're supporting, that then potentially shifts the type of production it comes from, right? So it's a bit of a supply and demand. So if there's more demand for, let's say, organic or regenerative produce, like we're just starting to see this, you know, there's a supermarket chain called Paris Farm here, sort of flying the flag for regen. You know, they've got a regen section in the supermarket. Like, this is nothing new for you guys. You guys seem to be, as I said, sort of way ahead of us. But the early adopters are Harris Farm, and now there's a section on their website, and there's a section in store dedicated to regen. And so obviously that's new for people, but you know, I anticipate in the next 3, 4, 5 years, perhaps other supermarket chains will sort of adopt that it's an alternative way to produce food. And so, you know, this echo chamber that we're currently in, it starts to bleed into the greater mass of people, the greater, you know, the broader demographic. And then you start to get a bit of momentum. And then if there's momentum and there's enough of us who want to buy more conscious food, then you know, pricks the ears up of farmers and growers and producers to maybe shift their methodology and their philosophy around food production.
Interesting. So when you talk about regenerative food, perhaps you could explain for people who might not have heard that, if we're trying to get outside the echo chamber, people who might not have heard that term before, what that means. And then also, if you remember, sorry, two questions at once, what that means. And that might explain kind of some of the barriers to accessibility that there are for that at the moment, and that need to be overcome.
From the food production side or from the consumer side?
Both, if you don't mind. If you can.
regen farming, the best way to describe that, I guess, is to look at the antithesis of that, which is the industrialized form of farming, or the intensive, which, you know, has been the sort of main player for, you know, the last 100 years, let's say. So that's represented by monocropping. So you see huge swathes of land dedicated to one single species. It might be corn or wheat or barley or rye. Gotcha. Similarly, it's represented by animal production, which is high density stocking, you know, whether that's chickens or feedlots with pigs or cattle. And quite often those animals are fed something to accelerate their growth in a bid to, you know, improve efficiencies and get that product to market in the quickest amount of time. And so it's often, you know, and when we talk about plants, it's often there's often chemical intervention. So when you're growing one single species, that rarely happens, if ever, in nature. And so to ensure the success of that plant, you've got to combat pesticides, you know, you've got to use herbicides and pesticides and fertilizer. And as a consequence of that, you're degrading soil, and those chemicals are then leaching into the waterways and eventually the human, you know, it has a consequence. All these things have a consequence. Yeah. And on the flip, when you're talking about animals, there's the consequence is that if you're using antibiotics and things of that nature and hormones, it's getting it into the human food chain. Okay. Not to discount the welfare of the animal. So that animal isn't living its best life. Mm. You know, it's not finishing its days on the paddock. It's not eating what it should in nature. So there's a compromise to its well-being. So that is a snapshot of the industrialized food system. I'm sure many of us have seen like the grotesque videos on YouTube or documentaries. Mm. It is a grotesque version of farming.
Mm.
Whether you're looking at, you know, either side of the ledger, if you're looking at arable farming, you know, plant or animal,
mm.
either has a potentially dire consequence to the local ecology and the environment at large.
Mm.
So let's put a neat bow around that and cast that aside for a second. The regenerative version of farming is the flip of that. Mm-hmm. So instead of chemical intervention, you allow nature to do what nature does.
Right.
You allow animals to experience life as close to as they would in nature.
Mm-hmm.
So there's less docking density stocking. You know, cows are not just starting life on pastures, they're finishing life on pastures.
Mm.
There's no pesticides, herbicides, fertilizers. So this is nothing new. Like this isn't a version of farming that, you know, just sprang out of the ground, you know, several years ago. This is how farming would have begun. You know, if we go back 200 years, all food would have been organic.
Mm.
But we've sort of lost our way a little bit. So regen is, you know, it's also been called like lazy farming because you kind of allow the property to rewild to a degree. You allow nature to do what nature does.
Right.
And so the benefit to a lot of this is that it allows the soil to repair. Mm. Now, the soil is something that many of us kind of probably don't spend too much time thinking about, but it's this, or can be this rich organic matter full of life, full of bacteria, full of fungi, mycorrhizal, mycelium. It's this living entity.
Mm.
And so if we allow, so I guess this is the huge distinction and why perhaps we should be getting behind regenerative farming. Mm. Instead of depleting soil and adding to the climate crisis that we have,
mm-hmm.
and damaging local ecology like in the intensive system, the regen system puts soil at the epicenter of the farm.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we manage livestock in a particular way called cell grazing,
right.
And so it sort of mobs the livestock together as they would in nature. So mm-hmm. you put any sort of livestock, if you look at any livestock in nature, they will mob together. And that's one of their line of defenses, right? So you look at wildebeest in the savannas, they're not all sprawled out having a merry old time. They've mobbed together to, you know, hopefully preserve the individual's life against predation. And that's exactly what a cow does. So they'll mob together. And if you orchestrate it that you restrict their pen to a degree or their paddock, and you allow them to munch on all the grasses over a 24-hour period, what we're doing there is we're keeping vegetation in a vegetative state and we're optimizing photosynthesis.
Right.
So what we're doing is we're moving them on after 24 hours to a new and a separate paddock.
Mm-hmm.
And we're optimizing photosynthesis in the paddock that they've just been into.
Wow.
So we're pulling carbon, so we're sequestering carbon from the atmosphere. We're locking that into the plant. Some of the plants are using the carbon dioxide for regrowth. So then the cattle can come back at a certain point and munch on that new grass again. Some of the carbon is being donated to bacteria, and some of the carbon is being locked into the soil. So now we're looking at a scenario where we can extract carbon from the atmosphere rather than contribute carbon through poor agricultural management.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the sort of the telling difference between regen and industrialized farming. Industrialized mm-hmm. farming contributes in a small or large way to poorer local ecology outcomes
mm-hmm.
and the broader environment at large. Whereas mm-hmm. this other version, the sort of lazier version where you allow nature to do what nature does, there's better outcomes right across the board. And in particular with, you know, this soil is this brown organic matter that we walk over when, you know, when we're walking through the rural parts of England. And we don't pay it much attention, but it's mm-hmm. this thing that we should pay a greater attention to. It's sort of, I guess it's sort of under our feet. It's much ignored, but it if we start to pay attention to soil
mm-hmm.
and particularly the health of soil, we can sort of, I guess that's the regen part of it. It's not. It goes beyond sustainable. The sustainable sort of gives the impression that it's equal on both sides, right? It's sustainable. You can sustain it. But the regen version is that it's you're improving the soil, you're improving carbon sequestration, and that's only a good thing in our current state, you know? And I forget what the other question was, the barriers. I guess the barriers is from the food production end of things, change is confronting for farmers and growers and producers. Mm. You know, my own experience, we have a farm about 5 or 6 hours north.
Mm-hmm.
The farm manager there, a beautiful man called Mick, he took over from his father, who's also called Mick, so Mick Senior. Mick Senior had managed the land for like, you know, 20 or 30 years.
Wow.
And he'd managed it in a very sort of typical kind of industrialized way. He'd slash, he'd burn, he would plant, fertilize, keep things at bay with herbicides and fertilizers. And that's what he'd done for year in, year out. You know, and he'd sent his cattle to feedlots to finish them off, you know, all very sort of stock standard. And then young Mick, so there was a period where the two of them is sort of a, you know, handover period, and young Mick was learning the ropes, and then he was let go and set free and set solo on the property. Over a course of about 5 years, his ears and eyes pricked up to the notion that there's other ways to do things.
Right.
And maybe sort of, you know, it was kind of appealing to be the lazy farmer because, you know, less hours on the land and maybe more time with the family, and maybe there's a bit of that going on.
Mm.
But essentially he transitioned to a more regen way of farming. You know, he was reading books on the subject and listening to podcasts and sort of schooling himself on this alternative way.
Right.
And so there was this friction between Mick Senior and Mick Junior. And Mick Senior thought, well, you're setting yourself up for failure. This will fail.
Mm.
It's new and it's novel and it's cute, but it's going to fail.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's perhaps indicative of what we're experiencing in Australia, that there's an old school guard that are reluctant for change.
Mm. Change is
scary. Mm. And there's a risk that change causes a loss in revenue and a loss in, and so thankfully there are organizations that help to bridge that gap through first of all, education, and then there's grants and initiatives that help farmers and producers sort of potentially bridge that gap between, you know, one methodology of farming and another, and if there's any sort of downturn in revenue that they'll plug those holes. But what I've experienced in the 18 months that we've had the Good Farm, so the Good Farm started life as a cow share scheme because we wanted to pull the cattle off our own property and consume that for ourselves because we were struggling to find the type of meat that we wanted to eat.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, it started off as a cow share scheme, fast forward a short time, and we were a online regen butcher, if you like.
Right.
So we were plugging into not only our farm, but other regen farmers, small farmers, you know, like small family farms, nothing of scale necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all young, like some of them were like really young.
Yeah.
So they perhaps inherited, you know, land from their parents or optioned some of the property for themselves to sort of see if they can make it work. But they were like farmers in their early 20s.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's what I mean. There's almost like this new guard of coming through.
Mm.
They're young. They're leaving the city for mm-hmm. some sea change, give it a go, you know, small kids. Like there seems to be this new wave of farmers in this country, because which is great. And yeah. I think that's probably where it has to come from, because the older generation, you know, we're all susceptible, I guess, to being stuck in our ways a little bit, and yeah. change is confronting, and it can be scary. So maybe you know, these young, enthusiastic farmers might be the guys that are leading the charge.
I think you see that in most industries, particularly when people get towards retirement, or you know, you see 10 years before I'm going to stop, so do I really want to start something new now? So the, like you say, people in their early their 20s, they their whole life they've been dealing with the climate crisis. It's been front and center in the papers. I mean, we were talking about climate change, fossil fuels running out when I was at school in like the 80s and 90s, but for the next generation it's been even more so. And values have changed. You mentioned families, like spending more time with your family, particularly like following the pandemic, like that I've seen this huge wave of people, just what is important to them is completely different. It's completely changing. They're valuing their nearest and dearest, and yeah, that's brought a sea of change in the way that people approach their lives. And I wonder if that's kind of translating into business in that way.
Yeah, I think the pandemic forced us to think about these types of things more than we perhaps had in the past. It's definitely, I'm sure it's the same over there, it's definitely remodeled how we work.
Mm.
There's a lot of us that, you know, have to, or historically have had to have gone into an office, you know, and done the 9-to-5. That is not to say it's not a thing here, but it's, you know, people, heaps of people are working from home or going to the office, you know, twice a week or whatever it may be. you know, everyone's on Zoom, everyone's, you know, sort of. And I think it works for a lot of people. People have kids, family, and so if there's a more sort of middle ground that we can be more pliable with work and family and life and leisure, and you know, that's only a good thing. Like, I think the days of going to an office for 8 or 9 hours is sort of, it's dissolving a little bit, you know. It's it's not the status quo so much anymore. It's not the norm.
Yeah.
And maybe we needed something as catastrophic and extreme as a pandemic to kind of shake things up. And I think also that, you know, to piggyback on what you were saying, like it because we were suddenly isolated and fragmented, it sort of, it made us realize, it showed a mirror to what's important in life. And sure, you've got to make money and you've got to pay your bills. That's the unfortunate thing about this world.
How the world works.
How the world works. But you need family, you need connection. And that was evident through all those weeks and months of isolation, that we need connection. And so that was another beautiful thing that came out of it, is that A, it got to reshape how we work, but how important friends and family and connection is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. When you were talking, I realized that I had never really considered soil as one of the part of the planetary boundaries that we need to live in to sustain humanity. And it's really been an eye-opener, because, you know, I think soil is such an important part of the climate crisis. You were talking about carbon sequestration. It's just another thing that we need to look after. But the way that you talk about the regeneration of it, and it's not even just maintaining a level, there's an opportunity there to make things better by doing this. So, well, you've explained why isn't you just think, why are we not just doing this? Why is this not the way forward? You know, it's so frustrating. But like you say, change takes time.
Yeah, I think, you know, much like yourself, like I grew up, you know, I remember doing an exam or an essay when I was, I mean, this was like 94 or something. I got that right. Yeah, I was like, anyway, forget the year. I was about 17 or 18, and I was doing an exam, and it was about climate crisis and global warming, and, you know, looking at renewables, wind and solar, and that's been the sort of the paradigm and the discussion for the last 30 years, right? Like, we've got
to
reduce our fossil fuel consumption. We've got to have more wind turbines. And you guys, back to you guys, like, you guys are smashing that. Like, you got turbines everywhere out to sea. You know, there was heaps. Like, there's none here. Well, there are, but you just don't see them. But, you know, we've got to have more wind turbines. We've got to do tidal and solar. And I guess who would have thought that probably the biggest benefit to reducing atmospheric carbon is beneath our feet? Who would have thought that it's cattle, if you manage them in a particular way, can be a huge asset to the solution, rather than the much maligned paradigm about cattle and methane. And you know, there's a lot of fluff around this stuff. There's a lot of, excuse my friend, bullshit on. You know, I don't really subscribe to cattle being the huge contributor of the problem. Yes, they do belch methane. There's no question about that. But if you look into, you know, the mechanism of that cycle, it is a cycle. So if you think about what the cow's eating, it's eating. And so I guess the distinction here, the caveat here, is that I'm talking about the regen version of farming. I'm not talking about the intensive.
Yeah.
So a cow in an intensive version of farming is sitting in a feedlot towards the, you know, the back end of its life, you know, the last minimum-ish typical 50-day period. But anywhere north of that, up to 400 days, is spending in a feedlot. And once it's in a feedlot, you're taking it away from that beautiful, natural, cyclical, beneficial role that it can have. So let's just push that to one side. There is a cycle that the cow is contributing to, and so when it's when it's munching on grass, it's taking, you know, where is that, how is that grass grown? It's grown from the conversion of carbon in the atmosphere, and it's turned it into sugars, and it's grown the grass. And so we're pulling carbon out, it's ingesting it, it's burping out methane. The methane breaks down over, you know, a 7-year period, and it breaks down into carbon dioxide. And so then it gets uptaken by the vegetation, and around we go. It's not that there are more there's more hooves on the ground than there ever was. Like, that's, you know, there was a period in the States where there was bison, you know, millions of bison roaming the plains. So it's not like there's more cattle, and so there's more belching going on, and it's more, it's all cyclical, it's all wrapped up in this cycle. And so there's a little bit of a nuance discussion around cows and their contribution to the climate crisis. It's not just cows are inherently pernicious to the planet. Like, you have to pull that apart a little bit, and you go, okay, well, it depends. It depends on one thing in particular, and that's how it's finished its life. All cows start their life on grass. Like, that's something that's somewhat misunderstood too. Every, you know, whether it's an animal or a beast here in Australia, in the UK or the States, it'll start its life on pasture, in a paddock. You know, the quality of that paddock is, you know, up for discussion, but that's how it starts its life. It's how it finishes its life. And it's that period there that you're removing it as a tool to repair the ground and to repair the soil and to sequester carbon, because it's not munching on grass anymore. So I guess it's a bit of a new, I guess with all this stuff, and it's heightened through social media, we become it's not an arena for nuanced discussion. You're either in one camp or you're in another. You're either in with me or you're out. And so, you know, I've found this off late with social media. I'm rarely on social media anymore. If I am, I sort of post and piss off. Like,
post and piss off. I love that.
Because it's, you know, people are either behind you 100%, or they're, you know, they're ready to take you down, and the things they'll say to you, I doubt highly that they'd say to you if they bumped into you on the street. And so we can, with tribal people, you know, we want to be in one camp or the other. We want comrades, we want allies, and we want to throw stones when we're confronted with a different paradigm, you know. And so the climate crisis I mean, here's the other thing, and this might sound contentious, but I'm starting to learn. So, you know, for the last 30 odd years, as I've said, I've been, as you have, we've been bombarded with this narrative that there's a climate crisis and we need to improve renewables and decrease fossil fuels. And I'm not saying that that's a nonsense. There is a problem, that there's no denying that. How much of it is contributed to man-made, to be a man-made problem, is up for discussion, I think. How much renewables are going to contribute in the short term is up for grabs as well. But this whole catastrophizing, you know, some people believe that we've got like 12 years or 14 years, I forget what the exact number is, but there's this sort of narrative amongst some people that there's like, you know, the clock is well and truly ticking and we've got like little over a decade to pull our socks up and save ourselves and the planet. That's just rubbish. And it doesn't serve anyone in the sense that, you know, particularly the youth, right? The kids, you know, that's a pretty dire, pessimistic, unrealistic view of what's really happening. Like, we're not going to implode in the next decade. So I think through the media, there's a lot of catastrophizing, and I just don't. I'm starting to not put too much gravity, you know, attach too much gravity to it. I think we will be okay. We are very adept as humans. We will work it out. I don't necessarily think the solution is in I don't think necessarily the solution is in electric cars but you know, I was talking to my wife about this the other day, that we are in this phase, and how long it will last, I don't know. And perhaps I won't be around long enough to sort of witness it. But we're in this phase, we're in this epoch where all of a sudden, you know, there was the industrialized revolution and oil and gas and coal that served that period very well. We were able to, you know, scale and industrialize and, you know, be the backbone for a capitalist movement and see growth right across the world, lift up poverty and then we realized that there was a shelf life to all this stuff, and we were potentially contributing to a climate crisis, and so we had to rethink the model. We had to rethink where, you know, what fuels economy. And so we're just in this period now where we're sort of like, oh, you know, we're fumbling in the dark a little bit, like how do we remedy this? Some things, you know, are trialed and tested and don't work out. But, you know, it might be like 50 or 100 years or 200 years until we go, okay, we found a legitimate solution to where we get our energy from. You know, carbon levels have stabilized, and, you know, it might just take, you know, whatever the period is, to sort of really get a handle on what the long-term solution is. But we're very adept. We will work out. Yeah. I'm sort of like jumping around a little bit, but I guess I just wanted to sort of convey that there is this media spin around the impending doom that is, you know, looming. Like, I just don't believe that anymore.
I think we won't have time to go into this today, but I definitely don't. We agree to disagree on the 1.5 degrees limit, because I do think that there is a lot of scientific proof that global warming has significantly increased since the Industrial Revolution, and that is man-made.
Yeah,
however, what I completely agree with you on is that catastrophizing it doesn't help anybody. And what I really love about what you're doing in your business is that it's really positive. And I think when we get overwhelmed with the task ahead as individuals, looking at businesses like your business, which is doing something that's so good and regenerative and is providing a solution and more than that, like, that's what we have to think about. Like, that's why businesses like yours and the people I speak to on this podcast are so empowering and so inspiring and just can really lift you up into, like, that, you know, like you say, maybe it takes 100, 200 years, but the solutions are out there and there are people out there doing the do and just getting on with it. And if you feel like disempowered by the media, like the headlines in the press are always going to be negative. That's what unfortunately seems to sell media. But and maybe it's getting back in the echo chamber that we were talking about at the beginning, you know, the echo chamber of the people who are doing the good stuff really gives you hope. And I think that's what we've really got to keep when all those dire messages are going out there. It's got to be the hope that you know, this is possible. And it is possible, because it's possible. Like you say, human beings have adapted to many situations over the years. So we haven't been here that many years compared to like the dinosaurs, but we do adapt and we are able to adapt. And if we remember that we are social community animals, that we work best with other people, going back to what you're saying about what the pandemic, what values that realized for us, that's where our talent lies. And unfortunately, the media and social media, all seems to want to happen is just to divide everybody. You've got to be, like you said, on one camp or the other. Nobody wants to have a conversation and talk about these things. And people that get too scared to have an opinion and discuss it or listen to somebody else's opinion who has a different opinion to them and just understand the world and think a bit critically. So as I'm hearing you talk about your business, I'm thinking, yes, this brings so much hope, because you're answering so many different aspects of the difficulties that people are faced with like animal welfare, you know, nutrition in your food, soil regeneration, carbon sinks, carbon emissions. It's really hopeful to hear.
Yeah, well, thanks, Charlie. I think, you're exactly right. The catastrophization of by the media about our predicament sort of, it disables people, right? You go the individual level, they're like, oh, this thing is like, you know, insurmountable. What can I do as an individual?
Yeah.
You know, we're always told to like make sure you turn off any lights that you don't need, and you know, I don't know whether people do that anymore, but
we do now to save money because electricity's so expensive.
Yeah, when it hits you in the pocket, it's a bit more like, oh yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, that's probably not a bad thing. But it just sort of like, okay, well, that's as much as I can do, you know, and that's not to discredit that, you know, we should be doing that.
Yeah.
But it does give you that sense of like me as a person, as an individual, faced against this juggernaut of a impending issue, like what I'm, it's like, you know, it's disabling.
Yeah, it is.
I guess my business and the philosophy around it gives people the opportunity to contribute in a meaningful way. So if they, you know, we're just a small business, a family business. But part of what I'm doing is, as I said, sort of being a player in remodeling the food system. And if someone chooses to plug into this particular food system, then you are contributing. You are switching your light off in a different way.
Yeah.
Because you're advocating for a particular farming methodology that sequesters carbon. I implore everyone listening to this to, once you finish listening to this, go and check out a guy called Alan Savory.
Alan Savory.
He founded the Alan Savory Institute in Africa. He's a environmentalist, he's an ecologist, he's a farmer. And go and watch his TED talk. And if you don't find that inspiring, you know, I'll eat my hat. But
it's Alan Savory.
it's a TED talk, so whatever that is, 14 minutes, so it's digestible. And he flies the flag for this type of farming and this type of agriculture. And he's talking about the desertified areas of the equatorial belt.
Yeah.
And he's suggesting, and it's all through, real life data, that he's transformed desertified regions and areas into lush grasslands with the use of livestock. So he's using livestock as a tool, and he's sequestering carbon and turning desertified, cragged land, dry, crumbly land into well-bound, water-absorbed, a carbon-rich soil can hold more water. So in desertified arid regions like Africa and even here in Australia, that's a huge theme. And so he proclaims that he, through, a different methodology, using cattle as a tool, if you like, so the epicenter is soil, but you're using livestock to enhance the quality of the soil. You can turn like these huge desertified areas of the world, we can rewild them essentially, which is a huge thing in the UK, I know.
Mm.
And so if you're turning these sort of dead zones or desertified areas, you can see it from the satellite images, right? These aren't small areas of the world. Yeah. If you can transform these from desertified areas to vegetative areas, like lush areas, like you're greening parts of the planet that are otherwise not green, all shrubs, bushes, trees, grass, the only way that they can grow, the only way that they know how, and that's to sequester carbon.
Yeah.
And that's amazing. It is amazing. So Alan Savory TED Talk would be a great place to start.
Well, I'll find that and I'll
hearing in.
I will add that to the show notes. I'll be watching that after we finish this conversation. And that is a name that you're not going to forget as well, Alan Savory.
Good one.
So I'm going to end our conversation today with the question that we ask all of our podcast guests, and that is, do you think there is such a thing as a truly sustainable business?
Do I think there's such a thing as a truly sustainable business? Yeah, I do. I do. Yeah, I'd go beyond that, and I think, sustainable, as we mentioned, is sort of implies that there's a balance between the in and the out, if you like. Mm-hmm. It's the word sustainable is that, that's the way I interpret it. That maybe I'm alone in that, but if you sustain something, all things remain equal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's achievable for a lot of businesses, and we're all sort of erring towards at least attempting to be more sustainable. But I think there are businesses that can be, you know, can be a step beyond that. You know, we're in the process of becoming B Corp certified, which means, for any listeners unfamiliar with that, do you guys have that? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. One of the hats I wear, agency I work for is B Corp certified. We've also had a B Corp consultant on this podcast who explained, okay. Andy Hawkins. So it's quite a tricky thing to get, isn't it? How are you finding the process?
Tricky.
Yeah.
Tricky. Maybe we should talk offline about it, but but it should be tricky.
It should be, exactly.
Yeah. And I think even if we don't get there, I think the checks and balances in the process to hopefully getting there, like, gets you to sort of reassess, are there better ways to do it? Are there better supply partners? Is there a better way of looking at our business from go to woe? So even if we don't get there, and I really hope that we do, I think it sort of cracks the whip a little bit, and improves your business and every aspect of your business.
Yeah,
it's not just about, you know, how do we, you know, potentially improve the planet. It's about, you know, are we being fair? Are we being equal? Are we, you know, it just gets you to, like, look at your business in a very meaningful way. And so, yeah, I do feel like there are, you can have a truly sustainable or even the next level above that business. And I think in all industries, we seem to be erring towards that. Mm. There's almost like an expectation that we should and must, and there's a lot of greenwashing that goes along with that, but I think by and large, you know, most within each industry, there seems to be a bit of a nod towards sustainability, and fairness and equality, and so I think that's just a wonderful thing, you know.
I completely agree. It's great to see it being taken seriously, and people that you don't expect to be talking about it or thinking about it to be talking and thinking about it. And there was this conversation I was having recently about, you know, do we need to stop being so harsh at the bigger brands that are trying and get it wrong, and instead celebrate the smaller wins? I mean, we could have a whole other podcast episode on that. And I know you got to get on with your day, and I'm so jealous because the sun is streaming in on the Zoom.
Kind of blinding, but I'm not going to complain.
So I won't take up any more of your time today, but thank you so much for this incredibly enlightening, interesting conversation. I feel like I've come back to Australia for an hour, and I can't believe that you're now going to go and have a beautiful day in the sunshine, and it's nighttime here and it's cold.
Well, you're always welcome back, Charlie.
Well, when I come back, hopefully soon at some point in the future, I'll look you up for sure. Thank you so much for your time today, Scott.
All right, no worries. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to today's episode. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Scott. If you would like to learn more about The Good Farm Shop, you can do that by heading to the website, thegoodfarmshop.com. A link will be in the show notes, where I've also put the link to Alan Savory's TED Talk, and also in the episode transcript, which you can find at easybeinggreenpodcast.com. If you liked this episode, it would mean the absolute world to me if you could subscribe or follow this podcast on your favourite podcast app. We are on Apple, Spotify, Google and Anchor FM. And I'd be even more grateful for your 5-star review, which helps other people find these conversations. Perhaps you know somebody who might like these conversations. Do share this podcast with them. If you'd like to get in touch with me about this episode or have ideas for a future one, you can do that by following at The Easy Being Green Podcast on Instagram. I hope you can join me next time, when I'll be joined by Weston McIntosh from Virtue App. and we are going to be talking about how businesses can give back in an authentic way. It's a really good conversation, that one, so stay tuned for that. If you give us a follow or a subscribe on your favorite podcast app, you will never miss an episode again. Until next time, stay collected and don't forget to keep it green.